1 through 15. Some time after this, Jesus crossed to the far shore of the Sea of Galilee, that is, the Sea of Tiberias, and a great crowd of people followed him because they saw the signs he had performed by healing the sick. Then Jesus went up on a mountainside and sat down with his disciples. The Jewish Passover festival was near. When Jesus looked up and saw a great crowd coming toward him, he said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread for these people to eat?" He asked this only to test him, for he already had in mind what he was going to do. Philip answered him, "It would take more than half a year's wages to buy enough bread for each one to have a bite." Another of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, spoke up. "Here is a boy with 5 small barley loaves and 2 small fish, but how far will they go among so many?" Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." There was plenty of grass in that place, and they sat down. About 5,000 men were there. Jesus then took the loaves, gave thanks, and distributed to those who were seated as much as they wanted. He did the same with the fish. When they had all had enough to eat, he said to his disciples, "Gather the pieces that are left over. Let nothing be wasted." So they gathered them and filled 12 baskets with the pieces of the 5 barley loaves left over by those who had eaten. After the people saw the sign Jesus performed, they began to say, "Surely this is the prophet who is to come into the world." Jesus, knowing that they intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew again to a mountain by himself.
Someone asked me a question about a week ago that I think it changed my life forever. I think that if you were here with us, you heard the same question. Do you want to be healed? Billy helped us walk through a passage in John chapter 5 last week. And if you were with us, you remember we were at the pool of Bethsaida and we were imagining those colonnades, those steps, the water, the people there, and what Jesus did in that place, and how he walked up to a man who had been sick for 37 years and asked him a question: do you want to be healed? And we asked that question, we heard that question that Jesus is really asking all of us. Do you want to be healed? It's more than, do you want your pain to go away? Do you want to feel better? There's something deeper going on in this question. Do you want total deliverance? That's not really the question we wanted to be asked, but we need to be asked that question. Do you want total deliverance? Do you want to be healed? Why can I say that I was asked a question a week ago that changed my life forever? I mean, I didn't become a Christian last week. I was 10 years old when I first started to understand what the gospel was. I saw my life, my mother's life changed when she repented, and I knew this is what we needed. I didn't become a Christian last week, but I was asked a question last week that I think will have a lasting effect on my life. Do you want total deliverance? And if you do, you need to decide which Jesus you're going to go to for this total deliverance. Is it the transactional Jesus, the quid pro quo Jesus? The one that says, "Well, I scratch your back, now you scratch mine." Is it the Santa Claus fairy tale that motivates us to do good things and get candy? Or do you want the real thing? Do you want total deliverance, and do you recognize that there's only one Jesus that can give it to you? Why did this question change my life? I don't think I would be where I am today if that question wasn't asked to me last week. And the things that I experienced last week in my life, I had a hard week. And I was positioned to walk through that with God and to seek total healing and total deliverance. If we say yes to this question, yes, I want total deliverance. If we say that together, not just as a group of isolated individuals, but as a church body, we want total deliverance and we want the real thing. We want the real Jesus. We then have to be ready to see him for who he is, to take him at his word. What better way to do that than to jump in to a 24-hour period in the life of Jesus? I mean, if you had the chance to go back into the life of Jesus and just spend a day with him, which day would you pick? I really think this is the one we should go with. This is an incredible day of walking with Jesus to see him as he is, who he is, and how he is the one that can offer us total deliverance. I want to see God. Have you ever said that? Have you ever said that in your prayers? God, show me yourself. Show me who you are. You're not the only one who's prayed that prayer. You're not the only one of your generation, but you're not the only one in human history. Do you know that Moses is said to have had fellowship with God as if it was face to face, like they were friends? And yet there's a moment when Moses went up the mountain in the book of Exodus, having experienced deliverance from Egyptian bondage, walking through the waters, being parted through the Red Sea, through the desert, and up the mountain to receive God's law and be the mediator of the new covenant. And in chapter 33 and 34 of the book of Exodus, Moses is saying, God, you're telling us to follow you. We don't want to go there if you're not going to be with us. Show me your face. Let me see you. I want to see you. I want to know you. We've seen all these things that you can do, and yet there remains something to know about you. There's a hunger and a cry for intimacy in the words of Moses. And we cry those same words, God, let me see your face. And what does God say to Moses? We could hear these words and be saddened by what God says. He said, you can't see me. If you look at me, you'll die. But he said, I'll pass by you and you can see my glory. If you look at me, you'll die. There was a law against making any kind of graven images, any kind of statue or drawing of God. You couldn't walk into the Jewish temple and expect to see the pagan god, the stone dead image of Jupiter or Mars or Hercules. No Thor, no Captain America, none of our modern gods were there either. You can't see him. He's invisible. You can experience him. You can know him and even be invited into deep fellowship like Moses had. And yet there's something that remains to be seen and known. And Moses' cry of desperation, let me just see your face. And God said, I can't do that. You'll die. It's like saying, I want to see the sun, but if you look at it, you go blind. What is it about God's nature that we can't see? And if we even attempt to go there, we'll be utterly destroyed. I think the only person in the Old Testament who got even close to experiencing what it means to look at God, I think, was Job. When God came to him in a hurricane. And Job said, I am laid waste. Others have experienced in the Old Testament seeing the angel of the Lord and falling down like they were dead. But we need to see God's face. We need to seek his face. We need to jump into this story today. We need to recognize that there's something special about a face, something that we have been missing and deprived of lately. I met new people yesterday, and I have no idea what they look like. We have a strange way of experience, almost like what God is saying, if I pull the mask away, you'll die. But we need to see the face. We need FaceTime. We need to be together. There's something that we've been told is very dangerous about that right now. We need to be careful. But what is it about seeking to see each other's faces? Why is that so important? I think that God built that into his creation. Why was there a law against making an image of God so that we could worship that image? In the Old Testament, that was totally forbidden. If anybody did that, they would be cast out and have broken the covenant with God. Why can't we make an image of God and bow down and worship it? Well, the image of God was lost when we walked away from him, when we sinned. It was corrupted beyond recognition. And only God could put it right. And there's nothing we could do or carve out of wood or stone that could allow us to see God. We cannot hope to ever see simply just an image, a picture, a photograph, even if we're challenged to get out the construction paper and the crayons to draw a picture of God. You actually have to experience the narrative of God. It's a story. He is a living, breathing God. He is not a stone-dead statue. He's not an idea. He is a person with a face that wants to know you. And we want so desperately to see his face. We were warned, if you look at me, he says, you'll die. If you see me, you'll die. What does that mean for us? We've actually been told that we can't step into a relationship with God unless we die and are born again. As we are, we can never see him. But he wants to show himself to us. Let's step into this story today and let's experience this. Let's let God's Spirit guide us through this journey. You get one day to spend with him, and here we are. This is a historical event. This is not a parable from the life of or the teachings of Jesus. This is not an analogy or a metaphor. This is literally something that happened in time and space in history. It's a story starting with the multiplication of bread that we find in all four Gospels. All four Gospels, they're very different in that they overlap. And when we read them and experience them, we know that they're showing us one and the same Jesus. Gospel of John is radically different from the other three Gospels in the way that we're drawn through the narrative and life of Christ, the language and imagery that's used. And yet, we have this Gospel of John where we have the turning of water into wine, which we don't find that in the other Gospels. The raising of Lazarus, the conversation with the Samaritan woman. Nicodemus, that meeting at night to talk about what it means to be born again. So many stories that are not present in the other Gospels, but we get a window into Jesus' life. And at the end of the Gospel of John, the writer says, there are so many stories that we could never write them all down. The world has not enough space for the books that would be written to describe the life of Christ. But these stories are given to us for our faith, that we would believe in him and in that faith have life. So why is this story in John, as well as in the other three Gospels, the story of the multiplication of bread? And you know what? It's actually so important. Not only does it happen in all four Gospels, but in two of them, it happens twice. In the Gospels of Matthew and Mark, after the feeding of the 5,000, some time passes and another crowd has gathered, and this time it's 4,000, and Jesus does it again. And after that experience, immediately after feeding 4,000, Jesus makes a comment about the yeast of the Pharisees. And his disciples are going, oh, what's he talking about, yeast, bread? Or did we forget the bread? And Jesus said, no, you don't understand. Do you still not understand what's going on? Do you not understand the meaning of the bread still? And yet, unlike some of his parables, when he actually drew the disciples together and explained the meaning of those parables, he doesn't explain it. You have to experience it. You have to look at it, and you have to wrestle with it. And that's what I hope that we'll do this week. Even as last week we wrestled through these questions, do you want to be healed? Do you want true deliverance? And which Jesus is it that you're seeking to have a relationship with? If we all said, yes, I want the real Jesus. Yes, I want the deliverance that he's offering me. Well, here we go. The clock is ticking. This day has begun. The sun is up, and Jesus has gathered his disciples, the 12, and he's called them to go to a remote place. But before they can enjoy that experience of a little camp wilderness retreat with Jesus, the crowds show up because there is just too much momentum. This is happening because we can cross-reference this story with the other three Gospels. We know that this is happening after Jesus had sent out his disciples to all the towns and villages to preach the gospel, to heal the sick, to drive away the darkness. And people are seeing that there's power in this. There's something happening. Lives are being changed. And the people that have heard the good news of God's kingdom are seeking Jesus. And so before that they can experience their wilderness getaway, their leadership team retreat, there's crowds and crowds that have shown up. 5,000 men. That may be a way to just count up households, right? 5,000 families have showed up. 5,000 men, and also women and children that have shown up in this remote place to see Jesus. What is it about this hunger to see Jesus and to see his face? The force of his personality, the miracles that he's producing, flowing out of him, and is drawing people in. And he went up the mountain. Again, we see something similar in the life of Moses. Up the mountain. And the crowds are gathering, and he looked up, and he initiates a conversation. He said, "Philip, what are we going to do to feed all these people?" And Philip was probably like, "Yeah, very funny. What are we going to do to feed all these people?" And Jesus is saying, "No, I'm quite serious. It's not a joke. When was the last time you looked at a crowd of 5,000 or 10,000 people or have been in a crowd that size? It's probably been a while. Baseball game or football game. Maybe a really big concert or a festival. Would you even think to yourself, hey, I'd like to spend 8 months of my wages so that everybody could get a Triscuit or a Wheat Thin? You know, everybody could just get a little taste, and I'm just going to go ahead and spend 8 months of my life's labor on that." How dumb would that be? I think that Philip was pretty flabbergasted by this question. Where are we going to get food to feed all these people? It's a logistical nightmare. It's way too expensive. Why didn't they bring their own food? And it turns out, as Marta mentioned, it appears that the only person that brought any food was a little boy with a packed lunch. And if I was this little boy, I mean, we don't know what he was thinking or how he was motivated to give up his sack lunch. But here comes Andrew with a little boy's lunch. And I've never had, to my knowledge, my lunch money stolen, but I can imagine that would be upsetting. Especially if you're thinking, what difference would it make? Why not just let him eat his lunch? Because you're not going to pass all that out. It would make zero difference. It would have zero effect. There's no logic here to be seen. What is the point you're trying to make? So they're saying, well, here's this kid's got a lunch, but, I mean, we're just reinforcing the observation that Philip already made. This is an impossible task. I don't want to say that it was a stupid suggestion to try to feed all of these people, but there's nothing that we can do. Jesus says, have the people sit down. In the Gospel of Luke, Jesus says, have them group into groups of 50. And so they do that. And Jesus takes that offering and lifts it up and gives thanks and blesses it and begins breaking that bread. We have the benefit of hindsight. We know where this story is going. We know that ultimately on that last night, he also takes the bread and blesses it and breaks it. Again, reinforcing that imagery, the symbol of that bread, the body of Christ being broken for us. And he begins breaking it. And everybody is looking and seeing what is happening. They did not drive up a bunch of carts and truckloads of food to start passing it out then. This came from the humble offering that was multiplied in sight of all the people that came there that day. And the disciples distributed that bread. I read in a commentary a version of a sort of an explanation of this event to say, when the little boy offered his lunch, well, put it this way, another person said, well, if he's going to offer his lunch, I'm going to offer my lunch too. And then a third person offered up his lunch. And that spirit of sharing and giving swept through the crowd. And everybody was just inspired to share their lunch. And as we see at the end of this process of sharing, they're at first afraid that there wouldn't be enough, so they didn't offer that what they had. But it turns out there were 12 basketfuls left over. So if we could only be nudged in the right direction, inspired to do the right thing. Because we're good in our very nature, and all we need is a little bit of push in the right direction. No, that is not what happened this day. That is a poor excuse to try to explain this fundamental and central miracle, this revelation of the very person of who Christ is and what happened on that day. We were bankrupt when we showed up to look at this Jesus. We brought nothing good with us. And the humble, meager offering of a little child was laughable and pathetic in the face of this need. And yet, Jesus looked at that little boy and said, "You are part of my work." And he took that offering, and it was enough. No, it was more than enough. The abundance of God's goodness and grace is on display here. Why is this story of a miracle of multiplication of bread, found in four of the four Gospels, and in two of them it happens twice? We have six stories of the multiplication of bread. This has to be at the center of our understanding of who God is, of his very nature. We're walking through this day with him, and we've experienced this miracle, but do we even know what it means? At the end of the day, to have our bellies filled is a good thing. But is it really what was happening today? In 2 Peter, in the first chapter, verses 3 and 4, 2 Peter, this one of two letters that we have from the fisherman Peter, who was called to follow Jesus. He says these words that are so deeply meaningful and almost hard to imagine that a fisherman with his, do you imagine these hands that he ended up with through pulling these nets in and out every day, and the leathery skin that he had from just working on the sea every day, and somehow he's able to take up a quill and ink and produce these words, that God's divine power has granted to us all things that pertain to life and godliness through the knowledge of him who called us to his own glory and excellence, by which he has granted to us the precious and very great promises, so that through them, through these promises, you may become partakers of the divine nature. Having escaped from the corruption that is in the world because of sinful desire, you can become partakers, participants in the very nature of God. What happened on that day on that hillside was that people were called in to be partakers of the nature of God, to produce a sacrifice, an offering that was then multiplied to become more than enough. The very simple act of offering my little sack lunch became a moment in time where we have encapsulated the very nature of God and his calling for us to join in with that, for him to revive us and restore the very image that he intended to be for all of creation from the beginning of time, that image that was lost. But we've been saved from that. That is not our fate. That's not our story anymore. We've been brought from death to life to be partakers in the very nature of God. We can't look at him. If we do, we'll die. But unless we die, we can never see him. Does that break your brain the way it breaks mine? We can't look at him or we'll die. But unless we die, we'll never see him. We have to die to ourselves, to sin, and be raised again. These people were here on that day. They saw what happened. They were there because he had been healing so many. And they showed up and he fed them. And they said to each other, "This guy's got bread power. He's got bread just shooting out of his fingertips. What could we do with bread power?" Well, we look to my left, look to my right. We got a lot of people here. And if we got a guy with bread power, we can do a lot. Let's make him king. And Jesus was aware of what was happening in the crowd, what they were talking about. Do you remember his testing in the wilderness? And the devil says to him, after 40 days of fasting, he says, "Why don't you take that rock and make a nice buttery biscuit out of it and satisfy your hunger? You got bread power, don't you? Use your bread power." And Jesus says, no. It's not that kind of bread that I'm even talking about. That's not the bread I'm hungry for, he says. It's by the word of God that we live. That's the bread that gives life. These people saw him, the man with bread power, and they said, let's make him king. And Jesus said, no. That other temptation that the devil offered, I'll give you the kingdom of the world. Just worship me. And Jesus said, no. No. He withdrew. He sent the crowds home with full stomachs. And he sent his disciples to sail across the sea. And here we see the sun has gone down. Normally, we don't really combine these two stories, but this is happening. This is one day in the life of Jesus. And what can we learn if we just keep walking through the end of this day? His disciples are fighting against the wind and the waves. That same commentator on the Gospel of John who tried to make a case for people's generosity that produced the multiplication of bread, he also tried to say that walking on the water was actually just the Greek expression that means to walk on the seaside. And that it was a clear night with a full moon, and the disciples could clearly see Jesus walking in the light of the full moon. No, that is not what happened. We know this because we have all four Gospels, and this is that very same night when Jesus is walking on the waves. And in the Gospel of Mark, it says that he intended to pass them by. That same image of God's glory passing Moses by. And when they saw him, they were scared. They thought it was a ghost. How did they see him in the middle of the night? Well, we could hypothesize about there being a full moon. If you ever walked out on a night with a full moon, you know that you could see reasonably well, especially compared to a night with no moon, right? How did they see him walking on these waves? Let me tell you what I think. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was void and empty and topsy-turvy, and there was darkness over the deep. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And he separated the light from the darkness. And he called the light day, and the dark he called night. And there was evening and morning on day one. And God said, let the waters be separated. And he lifted and he raised and he created the upper waters and the lower waters. And to hold back the upper waters, he created a firmament, something firm, something strong to hold back the chaos of the waters. And he called it heaven. The sky, heaven. And on that second day, you could be there in that space that God created between the waters and see an endless ocean and an endless sky and nothing to stand on. And the only thing that is hard enough to stand on is heaven, the firmament, the firm foundation that's above us. That's the world that we live in when we step into Jesus Christ. It's an upside down world. We don't trust the ground that we stand on. We trust the rock of Jesus Christ. We trust in God's word, the kingdom of heaven. And on this night, when he had sent his apostles across the water, and he'd gone up the mountain, he saw them struggling against the waves, and he came down, walking on the water. In that very same environment that looks so much like the second day of creation, with nothing firm to stand on, Jesus, here he is, walking. And in the Gospel of Matthew, we have Peter who says, Lord, if it's you, let me come. But what does Jesus say when they first see him and they experience this terror, this fear? What is this, a ghost? What's happening here? What does he say as this light of God is passing by, opening their eyes? He says, take heart. Have courage. Don't be afraid. It's me. It's me. And actually, the very words that he said, take heart, I am. I am. That is the name of God that he revealed to Moses, to his people. The covenant name, I am. Take heart, I am. And Peter steps out, and of course he sinks ultimately, and Christ is there to take him in and bring them to the shore. And the story goes on. But what can we learn in this 24-hour day? Who is this Jesus? Did we say yes to that question of healing and total deliverance? Did that lead us to the next question? Did that lead us to the next stepping stone on this path to say, if I want, desperately want this true healing, this true deliverance, then I know it has to come from the true Jesus. And the very next step, that very next stepping stone on this path brings us to these experiences of witnessing who he is as this veil is being peeled away and we can look in and see the very face of God, see the heart of God through the actions of Jesus Christ. This is more than a painting. It is something that must be lived and experienced. It is something that should never leave us unchanged. Because what is happening in this story, even as he welcomed in a little boy to help with this great project of feeding the masses, and his disciples distributing that bread and people consuming that bread and after seeing that miracle, but not getting it, right? They didn't get it. And so he withdrew and sent them home and his disciples across the sea. And here they are struggling. And he comes to them in the darkness and his light is shining and they see him and they're scared. He says, don't be afraid. I am. Do we have the perception to see what he's trying to tell us here? That he's not only wanting to show himself to us, but he's inviting us in to himself to participate in that. A little while later in the Gospel of John in chapter 14, on that last night when Jesus is so passionately pouring out his heart to his disciples, Philip says, Lord, show us the Father, and it's enough for us. And Jesus said to him, I've been with you so long, and you still don't know me, Philip. Whoever has seen me has seen the Father. There's an answer to your request. Show me the Father. God, I want to see you. I want to see your face. How can you say, show us the Father? Do you not believe that I am in the Father and that the Father is in me? The words that I say to you, I do not speak by my own authority, but the Father who dwells in me does his works. Jesus says, believe me that I am in the Father and that the Father is in me, or else believe on the account of the works themselves. These actions of Jesus, the miracles flowing out of him, should awaken us and open our eyes to see that, yes, it's him. He says, truly I say to you, whoever believes in me will also do the works that I do, and greater works than these will he do, because I'm going to the Father. What? Whoever believes in me will do these same works? And Peter says in one of his letters, we have been given God's promises and everything that we need for this godly life to be partakers in God's very nature. In this straight red line back to chapter 1 of Genesis, that God created man and woman in his image and in his likeness. And he commissioned them and blessed them and set them to be the living image of the living God and not the dead stone and crumbling image of the dead gods. No, that this living image of God, this is our original calling. It's being restored in Jesus. We're being asked to join him on this journey and being transformed by this, becoming partakers in the divine nature. What is the divine nature? What is this experience of walking with Jesus for one day mean? What is the image of Jesus multiplying and casting the bread out to feed the people and revealing himself on the waves? How does this inform us today? How does it change us, having looked at God's face and seen him? That's our discussion for this week. That is the stepping stone that's set out before us this week. I'm not going to tell you all the answers. Because I don't know. But there are things that God desperately wants to teach us. And even as a week ago, I was challenged and changed by a question. Do you want healing? Today we are challenged. And we can't do this challenge alone. We can't walk this path alone. We're not supposed to. Do you want to see the face of God? Do you want the veil to be taken away to see him as he is? Are you ready to be known as you are? Because he's looking at you too. Are you ready to cast yourselves into the arms of this God and be changed? To die to yourself and be raised again to walk with him? We are on this path. We are seeking his face. Right now, in response to what we have seen and experienced today, I believe it is time to bend our hearts to worship God. Now, we can ask the worship leaders to come out and lead us in that experience. To worship our God as he is, the real, living, one and only God. The God who takes my humble offering and makes it more than enough. Who changes me. The God who I can't see unless I'm willing to die first. And who gives me life. In Hebrews chapter 10, starting with verse 19, it says, therefore, since we have confidence to enter the holy places by the blood of Jesus, by the new and living way that he opened for us through the curtain that was torn, that is through his very flesh. And since we have a great priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart, in full assurance of faith, with our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold fast to the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. Let us consider how to stir up one another to love and good works, not neglecting to meet together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another, all the more as you see the day drawing near. We walk through a day in the life of Jesus and we're tired at the end of the day. What a day. And it's time to worship God. It's time to seek his face. And I pray that we will hear him say, take heart.